Welcome to Cambridge Science, an exploration of science by one curious amateur. That's me, your host, Richard Reddy. My friends call me Spanners, though, so I think we should be friends. And I get to talk to a real scientist who tells me science things. It's Dr. Andrew Holding. Hello, Dr. Andrew.
Good to see you. It's nice to be back here in Cambridge 105.
Yep. And we can see each other because of the technology of video. So I think we should fess up. I think we should be honest. We're not sat in the studio. We haven't been promoted to that yet. We record this remotely so it can fit in with our busy lives.
But this means we have a lovely studio all to ourselves. And I have a reasonable distance from you. So if I say anything that might be offensive, you can't hit me. No. Isn't it great, though? I mean, it's those things that we sort of all went through, the remote working, it's just given us technology actually doing useful stuff.
No, I didn't like that because before the pandemic, I got a bit of a jump on everybody else with remote recording. So actually, you forget, Zoom wasn't ubiquitous at the time. Skype was. So Zoom was our little secret, you see, because Zoom was catering for maximum quality, whereas Skype was trying to cater to things like grandparents talking to each other who might not necessarily, you know all the tech or have the best equipment. But you're absolutely right. You know, it's become much more common and it isn't strange for me at all to do this. And I'm so used to talking to you over Skype that it's not much different to when we were doing it in studio together, except I don't necessarily have to wear pants. I am because I choose to, but I don't have to. You can only see the top half.
Also, I remember some of the studios we've been in, the air conditioning did not exist.
Yeah,
and midsummer, that was, the smell was great.
Oh, I should clarify, because I was brought up with a lot of American English, when I say pants, that means trousers. I would not do it without underwear, that wouldn't be right. Yeah, that causes a lot of confusion in my house, because I always grew up with trousers being pants, but then underwear is also pants.
See, I always find the English weird on this one, because, right, underpants should go under pants.
Yeah, unless they're under trousers.
This is a great use of my PhD right now.
It is, isn't it? Dr. Holding and Spanners fail to get to the subject. Okay, but that's been a feature, not a bug. We've got some good science topics today. So we're going to cover the history, the development of, like, warring humans before they were proper humans, like post Homo erectus, but pre-agriculture.
Basically human evolution. So this was a study from the University of Cambridge.
Oh, wait. No, I was doing like a little preview thing where I was saying, coming up, we're going to do that.
Oh,
yeah.
Should we just do it?
I was going to say the other thing. What's the other thing? Was why we don't keep up with our friendships.
Yes, that was exactly it. Well, okay. It was more than that. It's a study about why people are hesitant to reach out to old friends.
Oh, do you know, really, really, I've got loads on that. Because as men in our mid-40s, I think we're probably the worst culprits in that regard. So, yeah, that will be an interesting one. But actually, first, I want to find out, you know, why we're doing this as live to make sure that you can get out on time. Because you're schmoozing. You're doing science-related kind of pub. This is the side of science that we don't know.
So, yeah, we have a series of seminars going on called Enhancing Research Culture. And what this is about is just acknowledging we can do better, right? You know, most places can. It's not necessarily saying there's something terrible, but we want to just see how we can improve what goes on. So we've done things about how you engage patients in your research or how you can work with industry to try and actually translate the discovery you've got into a product. That could be anything from, you know, pharmaceuticals to a widget that you put in the boot of a car, right, that does something magical. All those kind of things. What we're talking about tomorrow, and the speaker is, I'm going to catch up with him later, is how research publishing works and actually more about the job of being a scientific editor.
Excellent. And you need to know that because I guess the editor is somebody who is looking at your work when it comes to publishing it and whether it's good for peer review. So the editor is a bit of a gatekeeper for you as a scientist.
Yeah. So you get this weird thing when you talk to people like, oh, I published my research. People think you're going to get paid for publishing it, right? People think it's like a book or something. And, you know, some academic books do exist, but the type of scientific publishing I do is a paper inside a research journal. And to be honest, we usually end up paying them to publish in the journal. It's So really weird backwards to your normal thinking. But for us, if we can get into a really good journal, that has quite a lot of prestige to it. Like if it's in Nature or Cell, these are the really big journals that you hear people talk about.
Yeah.
They carry a prestige because only the best science gets in them. And
how much of your science has got into those ones?
I have no papers in Cell or Nature.
So are you more like a League One scientist?
So this is actually, yes and no. One of the key things is there's also more specialist journals. So Nature does all science, really. Whereas like our recent publication was specifically in a journal for that field. So whilst it's not seen as like the Premier League, it still can go to the right people. So there are things going on, and actually the cost associated with publishing and all this makes it very complicated, which is why it's really good to talk to an editor about what he thinks going on in the publishing world. But also, you're absolutely right. If I want to get into Nature, I have to write a cover letter, say, this paper is super important for these reasons. And I've got to convince that editor that it's even worth picking up the paper and reading it. Sometimes they don't.
No, it's amazing because you have to, you know, the specific language that they're looking out for, and you're only one of 1,000 scientists they're going to talk to that day. I do love the idea of grading you. I just think, you know, Dr. Holding, clever science man. But in the whole spectrum of the field, it's the same as me with the media. You know, I'm not on telly. It's not Premier League. I'm not on national radio. I'm not on, we're here on local radio, which is, I think, a good place to be speaking to a community. And I do make money, all my money from content creation. So I think that puts me League One, pushing for promotion, like maybe pushing for playoffs in League One in presenting. Where are you in science?
I mean, it's a very big top league, is what I'm going to say. We're a leading institute in the UK, which is pretty good for science, actually. So it depends where you do the cut. No. Am I the person who has Nature papers every week? No. But if I was getting Nature papers every week, I'm probably faking the data. So I think a lot of it, you've got to say, you can't make that. You can put things in place so you're more likely to get that groundbreaking result. Yeah. But actually, if you're doing good science, sometimes your groundbreaking result is a little bit like, oh, we did the science well. But it's not that general big thing that Nature wants, something that anyone in the science community wants to read, not people who do breast cancer research want to read.
Who was the electricity guy who, Nikola Tesla. Right. Okay, this may have been a Radio 4 program. I can't remember, but I was listening to this whole like hour of Nikola Tesla and how he had to create this persona around him. He both had a reputation as the lone maverick inventor, but also like a huge part of it was being out on the road making a show of all those demonstrations. And really, he did that. He did one good thing, which was the AC motor. He was head of that. But then none of the other stuff he really did was correct. But he was good at going out and doing the demonstrations. Now, if there's any family of Nikola Tesla that thinks that's an unfair portrayal, but basically he was going out with things that in the end weren't true, but had impressive stuff. So you could do that. You could just go full showboat for the fame and the money.
I mean, people probably do. It's how far do you get, though, when we're in a... Because your real... What defines you as a scientist, of course, is the quality of your science. So if you just went there and got really showy, if you go too far, it's not going to build a career because you lose that credit in the community of being a good scientist. You're like, well... And when you go to an editor's desk, they'll be like, we know this guy. He's a bit too showboaty. But at the same time, I've still got to sell my science. I've still got to say, why is it worth doing? And that is a very different skill to being a good person at the bench, to be able to go and say, look, this is actually really important. We found this discovery. And same goes when we're trying to get funding, whether it's charities or whether it's the UK government funding. You've got to say, look, you should fund this, and this is why it's important. If you just say, oh, I think this is a cool thing to look at, you might be right. But actually, UK government wants to know, well, how's this going to improve the UK economy? Where's this go? Where does it lead to? And it doesn't mean it's going to lead to it tomorrow, but they want to know they're not just handing money out freely. And the competition, again, for the money is huge because lots of people want to do cool science.
Mm.
Why your cool science?
I think I would bet, because knowing you fairly well, I bet that you're too far on the other side, that you're like sorry to bother you. I found this thing that may one day lead to cancer cures, but I don't want to be a fuss. I don't want to be a bother. In fact, forget I even called. I'm stupid. I'm just going to go.
It is a skill that I have had to learn And yeah, it's challenging because you don't want to overdo it either. If you overdo, like, I'm amazing, I'm the best person in the world, for sure, you sort of get people rolling their eyes at you. But you can't say, yeah, I'm mediocre, I'm okay. It's like, but it's not going to sell. You don't be too British about it. That's the key.
That is key. So my son's a bit like you. You know, he's a smart nerd, but very, you know, I'll say to him, oh, what have you been up to? Oh, nothing. Don't worry. It's not very good. And then I look over his shoulder and he's like coded a game that afternoon. And you go, oh, look, this is actually impressive. He's like, oh, is it? So what we need to do is we need to pair you scientists up with people like me that are all style, no substance. I'm on a science show. And our mutual friend, Liam Taylor, LT guitarist, who I'd love to find an excuse to get on here to talk about the science of music, he's actually sent me a DM. He goes, how on earth are you stealing a living on a science show? You. And I think angry about it. But that's because, look, what did I do? I took the meeting. I pitched it. I used your expertise. So that's what we need to do. Hybrid science communication.
But I think this is what's happening. And certainly when I started doing SciComm science communication, it must be about 2010 is when I really started doing quite a bit with media and things.
I know, you have done a lot, I'm being unfair to you.
But I say it was a lot more amateur back then. Like, over the last 15 years,
I'm like this.
It's become like a career for people. Like, the number of people I can think of on Twitter, on TV, on radio, and in fact, probably YouTube has been a really big part of this. The amount of people running and podcasts as well, who really live and breathe this. And they are much better than me at producing science content. They might have a PhD, but they've decided, you know what? I actually really like making YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And they make great YouTube videos. And I think that professionalization of science communication has been absolutely fantastic. But it does also mean people like me, who's like trying to also run a lab at the same time, it's made it harder to keep up with them. Because if I want to keep up with them, it's like,
you'd have to take time
to do the editing, the this, the that. And there's so many skills to make really, really polished content. But I think the more the merrier, right? The more good science communication out there. I do my thing, which is I'm still in a lab and I talk about it from my lab experience whilst trying to hopefully cross over with the media world when it's needed. And these people go, well, I did the lab stuff and now I'm going to just go full into doing the communication. And we serve a different purpose. And I think that's what's great about the internet. There's space for all of us now and it's all good.
Yeah, yeah. You put your time into wasting your time with me for an hour a week, which I appreciate so much. And then you spend a couple of hours with a random old American playing video games. But you do use that as an excuse to then talk about science while you're playing the video games. Twitch gaming streaming can be very hit and miss audience-wise. But if you're listening to this, go and search Andrew Holding on Twitch and you can catch him on a Thursday night. So you're usually around, 9 o'clock UK?
9.30
UK on a Thursday night, playing games, but also just talking about science. It's a good background hangout. I've done it a couple of times and hung out in the background. But the science communication is crazy. I've got a friend, Dan, Simon Dan. We've got a new podcast together called Final Written Notice. I wasn't deliberately setting that up as a plug, but he does a lot of flat earth science communication. So he's actually his maths is his background. But he just got into this flat earth stuff. And there's a big hardcore community now of growing community of flat earthers all around the globe. And I know you think that flat earth people are scammers. You don't think they genuinely believe the earth is flat. But I'll just finish this quickly. That Dan, though, he's had such a successful YouTube channel for the last 3 or 4 years, gets crazy views, has millions of subscribers, and has made that his whole job. But he serves a purpose, countering stuff that is obviously wrong.
I mean, I love Simon Dan's business model as well, because so much of the YouTube model is about getting clicks and likes. Flat earthers, they flock to him to tell him he's wrong. So he is literally funded by the people he's he hasn't done anything unreasonable. He's just I'm going to say that the earth is not flat. And apparently that has a business model. And I love that can exist in the YouTube
world. I love fact checking. So I like taking the claims of someone and saying why this isn't true. Because they come up with a lot of stuff like, the curve of the flight path proves that. In fact, flat earth, that's completely a science thing, isn't it? the curve of a flight path proves that the Earth can't be a globe, and because they don't take the shortest distance between one country and another. And then the one I got arguing with someone was about was sniper rounds. So if you're a sniper, you have to take into account.
As we all have tried at some point.
Well, I'm not a sniper, but I've been a marksman. So I, you know, if I would be shooting at an effective range of 500 meters and beyond. Yeah. But if you're a sniper and you start to get some more a kilometer, you have to take into account the curve of the Earth and the spin of the Earth. And so that's just a real thing that I know exists, a very normal part of my world back in my 20s. And I spoke to this flat earther and he says, well, no, they're just lying. So no, but that's, but I was, I've been there. I've been in that, and they're just out and out, flat out, just go, no, every sniper is lying about having to account for the curvature of the Earth.
And they're the people, I think, who are doing it to just annoy you.
Yeah, possibly,
because
that's
so, it's just such a way of thinking. That's quite hard, like, to that level of conspiracy is quite hard. We're the people who just maybe watch some YouTube videos and haven't really thought about it very much. Yeah. And I can believe that some people can do it, but I think there are people who literally do it because they like winding people up.
That's
like
possible.
Me.
So and it's not a good faith argument, is what you're saying.
And I've definitely, you know, had people who I've been in the pub with, and you can tell they're just trying to get a reaction out of me. And it might not be flatter, but it'll be something like that. The only one I really come down on hard is, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy over chemotherapy where it actually works for cancer.
Yeah, oh,
every
yeah.
so often you'll get a taxi driver who will ask, what do you do for a job? And you say, cancer research. And I go, oh, that none of that works. And you're like, and you just, the answer I always go to him is, look at any stats for any pharma company, and it will tell you the people who are at the top, their families, their kids, everyone they love gets cancer the same rate as the rest of us, these the same treatments as the rest of us. And I can tell you, one of those people would
expose
break it,
it,
right?
Yeah.
No one, most of us are, at least have some compassion for our own children. You know, yeah. That's a really, you wouldn't be able to get every company lined up like that. And that's the answer. If they were that conspiracy theory led, they're sneaking off and get a secret therapy, right? They wouldn't be that. So, and I will come down quite hard on my poor taxi driver if they do that. And usually they just get quiet at that point.
Or pub landlord in my case. I'll overshare, but this is true. This happened to me, I guess, 2008, not long before I got married. So my dad passed away around 2010 of lung cancer and throat cancer. And in the early stages of it, he went to see his friend, who was a pub landlord. We motorcycled down there and he heard about, oh, sorry to hear about that, Mike. But yeah, you don't want to be doing that chemo rubbish. No. That's all just to make money. What the big thing now is peanut-based remedies. So it was like peanut extract, and you want to be taking that, and you want to be taking a holistic approach to something. And my dad kind of absorbed it all, and he was kind of going, oh, okay. And it made him rethink his plan. And I really had to sit and talk him out of it. And, he did do chemo. It helped him to a certain extent, but it helped him to the extent that he attended our wedding and he was able to sort of die knowing that his grandson was on the way. And I genuinely believe he wouldn't have had that if he'd have listened to his friend saying, don't do actual cancer treatment and just take this peanut ointment.
Yeah, and it's a challenge that you see time and time again, that people get drawn into these alternatives. And the reality is these drugs work. And in the UK, the other thing is people talk about, oh, it's just about making money. You don't pay for your chemo here. You pay your taxes. It's done. It's not like you're going to have all this extra cost to you. And I can tell you, the NHS do not spare cash easily, right? You know, you don't sit there and go, oh, yeah, the NHS, all those big plush couches. No, it's quite pro budget, right?
Is it still Nice that runs the budgets?
So Nice are the people who decide what therapies you can and can't have, and it's the cost effective. So there's this horrible thing they have to do, which is talk about quality adjusted years. And if you're going to get a medicine, it has to meet a certain price point for every quality adjusted year. So if you're a young kid and we can give you a drug and that's going to let you live to 80, you will get a more expensive medicine than someone who is going to go live one more year.
Right.
And that's just the decision they make. And it's awful, but it's a reality.
So the older I get, the more expensive it is to keep me alive, in a way.
Well, it's the less likely they will put that into the NHS tools that I have. Aww. Because
oh no. But, well, okay, well, 50 is the next big one for you and me, so
yeah, but you know, it's someone has to make a decision what therapies we will and won't get, and that is literally that is where we are. You know, we live in a society where money is a thing, right? Until we get some utopian society where money doesn't exist, there's not a solution.
Star Trek. There are
certain drugs that get to bypass that, and that's where you hear about things like the cancer fund, or they make a special plea for something. But it still comes down to the government how they budget money for the NHS. That's where it all ends up. Someone has to pay for those drugs.
I have noticed the attitude to any injuries I get now is very different. You know, when you're 20s, when you're, especially if you've got a job like me that relied on your body, it's all about, right, how can we fix this? What surgery options are there? Let's get you back up and running. And now it's very much a managed decline now. It's like, yeah, I guess that your knee's just like that now, you know.
Yeah, and it's cost-effective, right?
Yeah.
They've got to. And I don't like to think about it too much because I like to sit there and think, no, we'll do what we can for you. But someone has to make that decision. And that, yeah, it's nice.
Got it. So to finish off this tangent, I've got some notes here from what we were talking about. Favourite flat earth things was a couple of flat earthers who set up an experiment where they set up two holes in like cardboard or whatever, and then they shone light through them. And their theory was if the earth indeed curves, then they wouldn't be able to see the light. If the earth is flat, they'd shine the light through a perfect line. I don't know how far apart they were. They'd be able to see the light and confirm the earth is flat. And then they do the experiment, realise they can't see the light. And he asks his friend, can you hold the light up above your head? And the light suddenly appears, accidentally proving the curvature of the earth. And this the classic moment of him going, interesting. And you go, well, at least you did the experiment. Because I think those guys were arguing in good faith that the earth was flat. And then they did the experiment. And you can't fault them until they actually doubled down and found loads of other reasons and then quietly disappeared.
Yeah, that is a very annoying video because you see them go and prove exactly what the textbook says you should see.
Yeah.
And then you can see them going that were for a moment where they go,
interesting.
Yeah, I don't want this answer. I'm going to change it. And that's not how science works. If you get an answer you don't like, you have to find out why.
Yeah.
That's where really interesting science happens often. Though,
when
to be
you're
fair,
wrong.
We know the world is a globe.
Yeah. So
an ablated spheroid. It's slightly off globe shape.
Yeah, it's fat around the middle, but I ain't no one to judge. So the flat earthers think that there's no Antarctica. That's actually just an ice wall that's like a ring around our whole world.
But is that hollow earth theory? That's like a different one.
No, it's not hollow earth. No, we're in the middle. We've got the North Pole in the middle, and then the South Pole is actually in any direction, you'll eventually hit the ice of Antarctica because it's an ice wall around you. And I say to Dan, I say, well, what if we just flew these people over the, you know, you can fly. You could charter a plane. And like, how much money would it take just to get a chartered plane, get 200 flat earthers on there, the genuine ones arguing in good faith, and go, okay, you guys, you're in on the flight plan. Yeah, you can watch the now let's just fly over Antarctica. Would that be enough evidence for them arguing in good faith? Or can we put them on a rocket and go, look, you get to go to space, so that part of the deal, it's worth it for you. We'll spend the money to send you to space, and then you shut up about flat earth forever. Like, how much money would it be worth to end the flat earth debate forever?
I'm going on the average space launch not being cheap, but this is not something that your GoFundMe is going to afford anytime soon. But even if you take like a really high altitude flight, and I don't mean like high as in like some special flight. If you go on a flight to the US, sometimes they fly like 42,000 feet.
Oh,
I think
wow,
it is.
Really?
I think that's, I'm not very good at airplanes, but
that's more than a mile.
You can see the Earth curvature at the top 747 service ceiling.
Yeah.
And you look out the window and you just see it.
There it is.
And you, and it's like, and I bet they're probably just like, oh, it's just the distortion
light
of the lens.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, there's no lens. It's a window. It was flat when you're on the ground. But
yeah, the conspiracy has to go deeper, that the airplane window manufacturer has to be in on it. So everyone who works at Derek Airplane Windows Inc. has to also be in on the conspiracy.
I mean, I love the idea that Boeing, who unfortunately don't seem to be able to make secure windows, is in a, got the ability to make every window make the Earth look round.
Let's talk about human evolution.
It's safer.
You're listening to Cambridge Science with me, Spanners, and Dr. Andrew Holding, and that was our longest ever Dr. Holding and Spanners failed to get to the topic. But I don't mind that at all. I've been wanting to talk about Flat Earth for a while. It's been niggling at me.
It's not an itch that you can scratch and let go away.
No, there's loads of stuff like that, like stuff that's obviously stupid. And the thing is, if I just start calling it out, you're going to get people who are angry because you're going to fall into somebody's sacred cow. It's a term I stole from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. But, you know, you have a lot of people who are very skeptical about a bunch of stuff, but then they're really happy about reflexology because they're dead into it and their aunt raised them on reflexology. And you go, oh, but can't you see that reflexology is not true in the same way iridology isn't true? Iridology, isn't it? The eye one.
But there's That's going to be iris, isn't it?
There's all those ologies where that aren't true. But yeah, you'll always upset someone because they have that one that they go, oh yeah, well, you know, I'm into cranial osteopathy for babies, which I couldn't believe.
Oh, I got recommended that once by
a
doctor.
No, I did. In the NHS, I was angry as well. And I was like, no, you're not going to. And the thing is, there's someone now listening who's generally skeptical, but is totally into cranial osteopathy and, you know, will email. And I think you should email Andrew Holding, presumably at gmail.com.
Well, we won't say I don't want that email, but the weird thing about that cranial osteopathy thing was I got recommended it for reflux for my child.
Yeah.
And the actual treatment you can get from GP is infant Gaviscon.
Yeah.
It's like...
Yeah. You don't need to crack the baby's neck. Yeah. I know it's not that exactly, but yes.
But it's just like, there's a really simple, harmless thing to do that, okay, if you give them too much, they're constipated. But you can solve that too, and just don't give them too much. And it works, right? It's antacid. It's safe. It's literally one of the most safe things you can give someone.
When my 14-year-old was an infant, so I guess pre-6 months, so baby, he only went once a week. And we really struggled with him. But it was like an event. So when it started, we were, it's happening, all hands on deck. I know, and it was a week's worth. But yeah, human evolution, tell me about this. And I believe we are Cambridge-based for this research.
Yeah, so the lead author on this study is Dr. Laura Van Holstein at the University of Cambridge, and she's a biological anthropologist at Clare College.
That is fancy.
It does sound, the Cambridge stuff does sound fancy. Yeah. But the colleges, they look pretty too. So this was published in the journal Nature, Ecology and Evolution, as we were discussing Nature brand journals earlier. And what they were looking at is how different hominids evolved. And also hominids are things a bit like humans. And what they found was most hominids evolve like most other species. So when they get to a point, they find a niche and the niche gets full, then they start basically reducing the number of species and extinction starts to happen because they're in competition. What happened in the study, which was really odd, is they then applied this to Homo species. So things like Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, things like that. And suddenly the specification, the appearance of species changed from it being when they became in limited resources, they started getting limited number of species. Actually, the number of species increased even faster, which is not standard.
Why?
Well, this is it.
Oh, okay. I've stumbled upon the question.
That is literally the question. Why? And they sort of looked around and see if they found any other examples happened in evolution. One of them they found was beetles on islands have this, where these constrained ecosystems can lead to these really weird evolutionary trends. But still didn't really explain what was going on here. So what they eventually came away with, and I think this is kind of a really cool point, is in the past, people said, oh, it was things like climate and this was driving the changes. But they put forward the idea in this study that actually what might be going on is evolution kind of happen faster once you have tools, right? Because if you have tool usage and you then want to go into a new area or expand, you can do it a lot faster because you can build a new tool, build a fire, much quicker when you can involve a new limb. I mean, I know people don't often involve limbs, but the ability for that spread just then became very, very quick. So they suddenly got this ability to exploit a new food, maybe.
Who's
So
they?
They didn't
Who's
have to
they, though?
evolve
Who's they?
all these
Different.
different types of
So
homo.
that's us. What, which gang are we in?
So we're Homo sapien, and we are like, what they sort of argue at the end is that Homo sapien was the ultimate one of these, the ultimate generalizer, and they have this amazingly flexible ability, which made us eventually expand to every other niche, which is why we now only have one of our species, right? We don't have Neanderthal, we don't have Florensis and these other species. So it happened in a different way. So this explosion of species happened when most things would have been shutting down. It was because of our tool usage, is what they suggest.
So more than just us Homo sapiens had the tools.
Yeah, so
Right.
I mean, Neanderthals are pretty smart too, and probably a bit less violent. But Homo sapiens and Homo Neanderthals used to like have babies together.
Right, yeah. But just the more Homo sapien ones survived more, I guess, or there was less Neanderthals around to contribute to that.
Well, I mean, we're hypothesis. Last time I was reading up on this, basically, eventually Homo sapiens just wiped them out. We weren't very friendly, but we do have genes that seem to be back
So how are
transferred
we a
back and
different
forth.
species to Neanderthals if we can interbreed? Okay, here's how I see speciation. Like, this is a good detour because I was talking to the kids about this. They were asking about dogs. I was like, well, I think all dogs are basically the same species as wolves. I think you can still breed a dog and a wolf.
I would expect so.
So then they haven't diverted enough to not be able to breed. And I thought that there comes a point where they can't produce fertile offspring. That to me was speciation. Obviously, you get hybrid things. So if you get a zebra and a donkey, you get a infertile zedonk offspring,
Or a donkey.
or a liger.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
their hybrids can exist, and there are some really unusual ones. So donkey and horses make mules, which is
Are
quite
they
a genetic.
can they breed?
So sometimes,
Oh,
but
really? So
it's
it's hit
not,
and miss. It's
it's
what?
really pushing. There's a lot of bad stuff going on at this
Oh.
point. And of course, with species of dogs, like you don't really want to breed a Chihuahua with a Great Dane. It's not a
Yeah, there's logistics, isn't there? There's physical
It's not,
logistics.
and but it does happen sometimes, and it's needs intervention, I would expect. I genuinely can't remember wolves and dogs can breed, and I would expect you have a real problem, the wolf and the dog not getting along. If you put two things in a
Well, I
cage and say,
really
go
get
for
on with my wife, but we
You don't eat each other, though, so that's
You heard us arguing
but you
pre-show.
also have you come across ring species?
No, please.
So ring species are fascinating. A lot of them aren't actually ring species when you get to it, but the easy examples are close enough. So what you find is, if you look at like gulls, like seagulls, herring gulls, these around the Arctic, they can't fly across the North Pole, so they can't
Why?
have babies across the North Pole. It's too cold.
Oh, okay.
But they can go east and west, right? So you end up with a circle round the pole. And what you find is the species on one side, if you took it to one on the other side, they couldn't have viable offspring. It's not possible. But they can breed with the species to the left and the right, so east and west.
Oh.
And the next one along can breed with the species to the east and west. And what you find is you might have six or seven species in a loop, all able to breed with one next to it. And then you go, well, when does it stop being the same species? Because
It's a loop.
it's a loop. And you find this also with salamanders around certain lakes, and you find, oh, this happens
That is
in places.
fascinating.
And it's always a bit complicated to say. Sometimes you find that actually some of them can actually breed across and some of them can't. And as I say, there's never, biology is always a bit messy, so it's never a perfect example. But what it means is trying to define species is hard. And just the fact we know that there was genetic crossover between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals doesn't mean they weren't a separate species. Also, at some point, they obviously branched off each other. So when that moment where something stops being a species is not going to be clear, right? Because what you're going to see a gradual decline in the ability to have cross babies. You're not going to suddenly go one day, boom, it's done. Now, it's also really because usually you say, well, you want the same number of chromosomes, right? So when they pair up and do that, but you don't have the same number of chromosomes between a horse and a donkey, and they get babies. So some things you can make happen, some things you can't.
Oh.
Lots of biology is quite messy.
I've just gone to wolf.org, so I can't vouch for the veracity or accuracy of wolf.org, but they say that you can get wolf dog hybrids, and the language they use is that dogs and wolves share an evolutionary past and thus display similar physical and behavioural traits. These two species are interfertile, meaning they can interbreed and produce viable offspring. But to me, the key thing is they're describing them as two species. So I still don't know what makes a species.
Someone decides.
Oh, is it? Is it that? So someone just goes, well, I reckon that's different enough. So that's a different species.
But I mean, this is what's really bonkers. I mean, if I suspect a wolf and a dog are close enough, because domestication can happen really fast. It's not a massive step. So I expect they have the same number of chromosomes. So when they pair off, they do brilliantly. A horse has 32 pairs, whereas a donkey has 31 pairs. That, by every textbook you read, is like, that's a no-no. You are going to have a mess. But what they end up with, a mule, is 63 chromosomes. So half, like, one of them is just unpaired.
So mules, are mules okay? Or do they?
Well, that's why we don't have many babies. Or like right, when okay. They try and split. But they obviously go through cell division. they're not great. But they also, you get this whole side effect. They're actually quite healthy in terms of a work animal. They're quite, people bred them because they're actually really good for doing the job they do.
Yeah. All right. So, okay. So I then think that someone has just decided Homo sapien, us, is different from Neanderthal, but perhaps, you know, it's closer to a difference is in, you know, a breed of something, because I feel like if they were having viable offspring, and that is indeed part of our genetics, it's hard to think of it as a completely distinct species, because we were successfully breeding.
But how often did it happen, and how healthy were they? And we don't know that. And that's the other challenge, right? I mean, we don't have anything to go and check and see how they're feeling. But the genetic drift is enough that nowadays we'll be like, that's...
Mm.
That every sign is that they're a different species. And, you know, you look at some of these things, like some of these little hobbit ones. You remember the whole thing they found, okay, the hobbit-type humanoids? You know...
They again, died out, yeah.
They all died out, right? But none of them are down at the pub. It's a real shame. Wouldn't it be cool to have... I mean, it probably would end very badly because people don't get along for all sorts of stupid reasons.
Oh, man.
But wouldn't it be cool to go down and have a drink with your local Neanderthal?
Yeah, I mean...
They weren't stupid. They would have been quite good. They would have been quite chill.
People are abusive and uncomfortable enough with people who are nearly genetically identical, except for a different melatonin count or different hair colour. I think if you were a completely different species of human, I think people would be entirely less kind. So, but at that time, before it was sort of decided where the various divisions of human had tools and were being able to expand, were they all? Because there was a few different ones, because that you had Denisovans as well.
Yep.
More towards the south of the equator. Did they survive? Did they interbreed also? Is there Denisovan DNA?
So what this article is saying is a lot of these species, the timeline shift, right? Because the fossils are hard to work out. But yeah. They're saying there's a lot more overlap than people previously thought. So that was another thing they're putting forward, is actually, yeah, loads of these were around. And then eventually, eventually Homo sapiens just decided to murder all the rest. But for a long while, there were several more species than previously assumed to be coexisting. So that's really cool.
I like it. You make it sound like a council decision. Like the Homo sapiens are sitting around going, right, that's it. All those others have got to go.
I think in more they just went, I want that.
Yeah.
And they're there.
Those resources. Yeah. Okay. So what I love about this kind of history, is human history, is it was all from the same pot of humans in Africa. So the Denisovans and the Neanderthals left first, I think.
So I believe the numbers are as ridiculous as Neanderthals have lived in Europe longer than Homo sapiens has, even today.
Oh, really? So they really got out there quickly.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those factoids that I sort of come across and go, that's cool. But so feel free to fact check me on that one.
No. But the thing is, it's relatively recent, the spread then of Homo sapiens historically out of Africa, took over, and now they're here. And because there was so much of our Homo sapien evolution was in Africa, there's more genetic diversity in Africa for humans than all the other humans in the world, which I just find absolutely fascinating. It's a relatively narrow genetic band that is the non-African humans.
And there were multiple events, it seems, where Homo sapiens left. But, yeah, waves is a good word for it. But the thing that comes up time and time again is when people are trying to, because people like to talk about race and define it, and scientists like me annoy people when they say, well, race doesn't really exist. And people go, well, I know this, you know, by looking at people, I know what they are, it's obvious. But when you actually do the genetic studies, every study I've seen that's done this scientifically goes, well, the difference between two people within a race is bigger than the differences between races that make them obvious. Yeah. So there's more diversity in each population than actually the difference between two races means, well, how do you make that? How does that make any sense? You're actually, what you're just saying is you're just going on a few features that you can discriminate on. That is literally what your brain's doing. It just likes to see things and go, oh, they're different.
But scientifically, there's got to be some evolution reason behind that. Because I think even people who are not outwardly, I'm trying to find the right word for when you discriminate against people who aren't like you.
Well, I mean, I'm just talking about discriminate. Yeah, in that scientific visual image. It's the way I discriminate between a tomato and an apple, right? It's not a...
Yeah.
I know it's a loaded term for other reasons.
But if you're somebody who is outwardly fair about all those things and would treat all humans the same, I think most people still have some innate thing where, you go, that person is like me, that person is not like me, and there's like a mental conversion. And I just think that that's somehow evolved in humans, and it's something that we're having to fight actively.
I mean, I think we all have unconscious bias. Sometimes we have very conscious bias. And yeah, I don't think it's true. There's a lot of arguments about, because a lot of companies like to do is unconscious bias training, whether it's effective or it's not. And that's I think that's more a debate how you deal with it. But you make snap judgments. We know that we know stereotypes exist, right? There's no doubt about it. I have a stereotype about a BMW driver. That's not the same level of issue, but they definitely exist. And yeah, we have to fight them. And I think sometimes it's a case of you going, look, I know I will make snap judgments, but that isn't actually useful. Or that isn't actually helpful to interacting with other people in getting the best team to achieve something, right? You want the best staff for a job. If you're making snap judgments on appearances, you're doing terribly.
And that snap judgment about BMW drivers is that they have worked hard to get into a position to get a premium car.
Yes, I'm sure that's what it is, isn't it?
I don't have a BMW. I tell you what, nice aside before we get into our final topic, I was having this discussion with my friends about what's important to you and what you spend your money on. Because I was looking at going to a gym that had, you know, mops that they use and occasionally clean the equipment. But my friend has a Mercedes, and he spends hundreds and hundreds of pounds a month servicing that lease or loan. I can't remember which one it is. But it would never occur to me to spend that money on a fancy car. I'm happy with my 2016 little pug. Bomb around.
Cars are a really interesting one, right? On what they tell you a lot about where people want to spend their money. Cars are so expensive.
Yeah.
And because we used to have two cars, and then in COVID we dropped down to one, and for various reasons we haven't gone back, just we haven't needed the second one. Because mine was on a lease and my wife's one was on, we owned outright, because it's one she learned to drive in. Or no, it's one she bought straight after a driving test. It was this tiny little Nissan. It was the Nissan Note, so people don't know, it's like the Micra, but they made it a little bit bigger by inflating it like a foot in the back.
Mini SUVs, or is that?
Yeah, it's like, but it's not even a mini SUV, is a big claim. It's like a Nissan Micra trying to be an SUV.
Okay,
even as big as it. It's
my Peugeot's a little bit like that. It's a Peugeot 206 on stilts, or sorry, a Peugeot 208 on stilts, basically. So it's just a little bit higher and a little bit.
I think this is more like a Peugeot 108 on stilts. And you know, no one ever gave me any grief for this car. It fit the pram and the boot. It made sense to have. But you'd pull up to events and you'd be turning up in your tiny car and there'd be these expensive cars. And you'd be going, I could buy four of these for the price of that car. And it does everything that car does that I need. It might not do some fancy, clever technology thing, but it gets me from A to B. It had air conditioning. It had all the parking stuff you need. And when I got a bill, the bills were never that expensive because
it's just,
the car wasn't expensive.
It's just spare hamsters, isn't it, that you got to put in there to turn the hamster wheel?
That's because it wasn't important to me to spend that money on a car, right? That's nothing against the person spending their money on that. It's just so much money.
But do you value spending time with friends? That's a segue. Hey. You're listening to the end of Cambridge Science. Frankly, you've missed the best bits. Now, this here's the news item that we didn't deem worthy to put at the top of the show, that we extended to the back end in case we ran out of time, which we nearly did, because the waffle has been off the charts. Saxophone, that's my friend. Matt Trumpets, he said I had to credit him, but I've forgotten the name of the band. City Line Trio, that's who it is. So if you happen to be in the New York area this Friday, you can catch them, but you're probably not. So you can't. Sorry about
that. How many local radio listeners are
transatlantic? This is it. He said to me, he said you can use the music, but you've got to plug the band. And I went, okay, I don't think it's going to do you any good. But if you're if you're into ska and you're in the Manhattan area, I know Brooklyn, if you're in Brooklyn, yeah, go check them out. And by the way, if you want to email us, you absolutely can. Always open to feedback and just to say hello, just to know there's people out there listening. Which email can I use? Just email me spannersready@gmail.com. Now, tell me, Dr. Holding, why does science think I don't have any friends?
So this was a study that's come out of Simon Fraser University and University of Sussex. And this was showing that rekindling old friendships is as scary as making new ones.
Oh, man. Is it ever? Continue.
So it's really interesting. So basically, they wanted to find... that's why we pick stuff, right?
Imagine if you'd have just gone, no, this is dull as hell.
This is dull. I picked the most boring... I should try and do that. What is the most boring study we can find 1 month?
Your work, probably.
That's supportive.
League one.
So what happened was they wanted to understand the people doing this study. What stops people from reconnecting? And why do these things happen? Now, it's important, right? Because the more friendships you have, generally the happier you are. Doesn't mean you want too many. You get to a certain level, people fade away and things move on, and that's fine. But generally, you don't want to be lonely, do you?
No. I've experienced loneliness, and I have friends that experienced loneliness. And I think people are getting more honest about talking about it. But my loneliest period was in my late 20s. And what it does is it really stops you prioritizing other things, because the loneliness feels like a crushing weight. And you're like, if I don't sort this out, how can I do anything? Nothing I do has meaning because I'm lonely. That's got to be genetic, hasn't it, as well? That's got to be evolution urging me not to be lonely.
You're a social animal. Yeah. That's what it's telling you.
I used to be.
I don't want to know. So this study was by two people who had reconnected themselves. So Professor Lara Aknin and Dr. Gillian Sandstrom. That's a great name.
You probably got both those right. Let's just assume you have.
I nearly got the second one wrong because, you know, I have dyslexia, so I was going to flip that O and R. But yeah, I got through it. You can survive with dyslexia. So they basically reconnect themselves and ask this question, why is it so hard to reconnect? And I think what's probably useful is if they actually went through and looked what helps people reconnect. Because people,
so did they feel, did they struggle to reconnect? Is that the tale?
I think they get more into the research than they do to their own personal life. Let's be fair, there probably is more to it. But what they were saying is actually when they asked people, how do you reconnect? What they found out was actually one, a good thing to do is practice on your current friends. And that might sound stupid, but you don't talk to your friend every 5 seconds. So you just practice by building up those connections to your friends and how you talk to them and how you deal with that. And that really helps you then go and talk to new people. And that's actually based on how people sort of are advised to learn how to talk to strangers and how to be friendly with people. Then the other thing they say is people find it really useful to reconnect when there's an excuse.
Yeah.
So New Year's Day, you send an email, their birthday, you send them a message. Basically, give yourself an excuse to email people or text them or whatever brand of messaging service you now use. And yeah, that's the advice. If you want to start reconnecting your friends...
I have to practice on my current friends.
Yeah, so you can practice with me right now.
No, do you know what? You're not a terrible example of this for me. There's people I know or used to know or do projects with, and I go... We could be better friends if I was better at just, hey, Andy, well, I've got a couple of days free. Let's find something to do. I'm really bad at doing that with, in fact, I have called you to go to the pub a couple of times. So we have done that.
But we have sat in the same pub.
But I actually find that really difficult because I do think, why would Andy want to spend his precious non-family time and non-work time just sitting in a pub with me? You know, there's a bit of an imposter syndrome when it comes to that.
And you're aware I have teenage children.
And that you would want to run away from.
I love my children. I really do. They would appreciate space from me.
This year, actually, and it started last year, it was one of my actual missions to go, I just must get better at making these human connections. It is really difficult to do. There's a guy I was in the army with in the early 2000s, and we are friends. I would say we are friends now. We ended up being colleagues again, which was cool. But before I got him that job, we reconnected very awkwardly by playing online games together. And I message him on Facebook and say, oh, I saw you like that game. Maybe we can play that game together. And the conversation was really awkward. It was difficult. We ended up podcasting together because that gave us the excuse, like you were saying. So we had the excuse, well, we can have this conversation in podcast land. But my goodness, it's just such a struggle. And even the guys I do podcasts with, so my co-host, Matt Trumpets, who does your Twitch stream as well, I speak to him twice, three times a week, always messaging. Whenever it comes to one of us is in America or here, I find that physical connection, it feels like a reconnection, extremely difficult. What is the hurdle that I'm facing is what I would want to know. Why can't I just go, hey, hang out with me?
Well, there's other things, right? And I'm not a psychologist, so I'm not going to start
just,
doing
just
that
pretend,
with you right now.
Just pretend.
Social anxiety, right, is a real thing.
Oh, is that what that is? Oh.
Well, I'm not diagnosing you right now. But that would be like an example. You're quite good on your phone because you're not in a social environment. We put you in a social environment and you have anxiety due to whatever happened in your childhood. No.
Well, I mean, once I'm there, like I can sit, I can have a conversation, it's fine. I just genuinely think that why would I want to impose myself on people's time, I think. And also, here's the other thing. So, for example, my cousin, Anthony, we were really close as kids, closest thing I had to a sibling. And I am always scared that I won't live up to that. So we were very close as kids. And whenever he comes around, it's absolutely fine. Lives in Denmark. But I'm always worried that he'll come around and you go, well, that's not the person I remember or something. And that makes it hard to reconnect. And I'm just sharing these things, oversharing, because there will probably be people listening who are struggling to pick up the phone and go, hey, Derek, we need to just go and have a beer.
But don't you think this is true of many things, not just friendship? Say you want to start a podcast, people will have anxiety. Oh, what if people don't like it? What if no one listens? And the answer is, I can guarantee if you don't make a podcast, you will never make a podcast. Like, but that's a one guarantee.
But
if
also, even if you do.
Maybe no one listens, but that's not a problem, right? Why does it matter?
No, it doesn't.
You're worrying about the wrong thing. The biggest way of failing to make a podcast is not to make a podcast. And I pick that one because it's something you and I come across quite a lot. Like, oh, go and do this. Like, just do it.
So the absolute guaranteed way to not reconnect with your old friend is to not message them and to not, yeah. But I think you have to kind of go, yeah, practicing with your existing friends is good. So being more open and connecting to them and saying, okay, I'm going to be braver to just call you.
Yeah. Phone, please don't phone millennials. They can't cope.
No, I can't. I'm not a millennial. I'm Gen X, but I can't cope with a phone call. Like when a phone actually rings and it's someone trying to speak to me, I just think it's the neediest thing in the world. And but that's wrong. I should pick up the phone when someone calls. I don't. Try calling me. When it's been long enough that I've forgotten about this, try actually phoning me. You will not get through.
I genuinely used to have it so my phone wouldn't ring.
My phone doesn't.
It would dump them to voicemail. It's not even silent. It was just like, and the only reason, it only would let me pick up for members of my family in my favourite list.
Oh.
Because if kids phone you, emergency, wife phones you, she knows not to phone me unless there's something important. So anyone else, I'll pick it up when I next look at the screen. And 99% of the time, it's phone calls, right?
The only reason I have a smartwatch is screening phone calls.
But I had to disable that because the NHS never uses a number on, like, if you have going through health things, suddenly you go, if you do that, you never ever get an appointment because they phone up and if you miss them, it's gone. So you have to pick up every call and go, it's an appointment. Oh no, it's just PPI. Okay. That's the only reason I started doing it. But absolutely, if you want to reach out to people, and we did get sidetracked into millennials' phobia of having phone calls, just send them a text, drop a message, drop an email. And the worst thing will happen is they don't reply. And that doesn't mean they don't like you. It just, things happen.
We're out of time. I would like to pick this one back up again. So the science of why we're terrible at making friends. Because I bet you there is a lot of people, but I think it's more weighted to men, who almost self-impose loneliness. I have an outlet because I do a lot of online content, and it lets me do that from my house, which is a lot easier. But I think that's one of the biggest social issues facing, especially, you know, dad-aged men, but not exclusively. So I do want to pick that up again. In 30 seconds, what does the study say we should do to solve this forever?
They don't give forever, but they reach out to people and just take it slow and
wait. So if you have a problem reaching out to people, the solution is
practice on your friends, which I mentioned.
Just reach out to people.
Yeah, practice on your friends. Find an excuse. Is it a birthday?
Be available.
Use Facebook to stalk them slightly. Doesn't say that. But,
be available. Be available.
Yeah. And you know, work on it. Mm-hmm. Like anything in life, it takes effort, but it's worth it. Because it will make you happier to have a social circle.
Thank you, Dr. Holding. Search Andrew Holding to find all his stuff, especially search Andrew Holding Twitch. Search for me as well, obviously, by searching for Spanners Ready or Richard Ready. Definitely follow me on stuff. I'm the best one out of us two. I know he is working on curing cancer, but I think my skill set of being able to press record and say things is much, much higher. Until we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Cambridge Science.